This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Each year, colleges and universities are required to report all of the crime statistics on or near campus from the previous year. It's part of the Federal Cleary Act, named after a 19-year-old student, Jean Cleary, who was raped and murdered in her dorm at Lehigh University in 1986. The statistics must be published and publicly available by October 1st. Those statistics include sexual assault, a particularly pernicious crime that campuses have been struggling to deal with. We're going to talk about what the statistics show us today on the show and how prevention efforts are an attempt to lower the number of assaults on campus. Let's first get a survey of a couple of local schools. Norwich University reported one forcible rape and one forcible fondling on campus last year. There were a couple incidences each of dating violence and stalking. At Middlebury College, the numbers spiked in 2013 with 17 accounts of forcible sex offense. This year, the college reported 9 incidences of rape. Excuse me while I turn the page here. Dartmouth College's numbers have been on the rise for a couple of years now. This year, the college reported 48 rapes and 7 instances of fondling for 2013. That's up from an equivalent of 35 forced sexual offenses in 2012. Now, the statistics only cover incidences that were reported. Actual occurrence is almost undeniably higher than the statistics suggest. And in some cases, schools welcome higher numbers because they say it suggests that more students are coming forward. We're going to talk about the issue of sexual assault on campus today, and I'm joined now by Chief Leanne Toomey. She is Chief of the University of Vermont Police Services. Nice to have you on the show, Chief Toomey.
Thanks, Jane. Good to be here.
And Amy Bremmel coordinates Castleton University's CHANGE program. CHANGE stands for Creating, Honoring, Advocating, Nurturing Gender Equity. She joins us from VPR studio at PEG TV in Rutland. Amy, it's a pleasure to have you with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the numbers at your respective universities, and we can extrapolate some of the other issues from there. UVM is reporting 27 rapes in 2014. That's up from 15 in 2013, and 2 accounts of fondling. That's up from 0 in 2013 and 2 in 2012. At Castleton is reporting 5 instances of rape, 2 fondling instances. That's up from 3 forcible sexual assaults in the previous 2 years. Chief Toomey, I'll start with you. What do those numbers represent to you?
Well, I think these numbers represent bad news and good news. The bad news is that we have these numbers. The good news is that we're getting closer at receiving the information on what's more likely occurring out there on the campuses, but also in Vermont and in the country in general. So I think that this is a good thing.
So you don't think the numbers having gone up from 2013 to 2014 is necessarily an indication of actual occurrences of a sexual assault going up on campus, just maybe more reporting?
Absolutely. And for the most part, the University of Vermont has taken great strides in getting the word out, having the message there, but also in training these folks that work on the campus that are constantly there for our students and our student population, in explaining to them what it is that they need to do in reporting these things. So opening up more ways for people to feel comfortable in reporting these difficult crimes.
Amy Bremmel, what about for you? What do Castleton's numbers represent?
Definitely the same kind of things, where we are training individuals, we have our students, our peer advocates for change, who are trained victims advocates, and they are out there spreading the message about opportunities or options for resources, what sexual assault looks like, resources both on and off campus, and avenues for reporting it.
So when you look at the numbers that are reported both to the school and then reported in the Cleary Act publicly, how do you think they equate to the number of assaults, sexual assaults that are occurring on campus?
I think it's definitely still the most underreported crime. The research has been repeated and keeps showing that it's the most underreported crime, where about 1 in 4 to 1 in 4 women have been the victim of sexual assault, and 1 in 8 to 1 in 10 men. So our numbers don't reflect that, but research is showing that that's really what's going on out there on college campuses.
Chief Toomey, you mentioned that you think at UVM some of these numbers are representing more students feeling comfortable coming forward and reporting sexual assault, rape, other instances of unwanted sexual advances. But what evidence do you have that that's true? I mean, we can look at statistics going up and say, boy, we hope that that's a sign that people are reporting more, not that it's just the same sort of degree of reporting with more crimes going up. So is there any way to actually calculate whether the actual instances of crimes are going up or you're seeing better reporting and the same or fewer crimes?
You know, that's a great question. And to start with, I can say I don't really know. What I know is the work that the University of Vermont has undertaken in really focusing on communicating with the campus security authorities and educating those folks on what their responsibilities are, on setting up really good systems and processes that are really clearly defined, that increase the outreach. The more tentacles that you have out there in the world, the more likely you are to get the contact with the people who need to be you know, taken care of and to get them the support that they need.
It seems like a hard nut to crack, though, in a way, because, you know, you want more people to report, but there's no way to tell, and the statistics still show that this crime is occurring, you know, at somewhat steady rates. So it's hard to tell if there's better reporting or more crime going up.
Yes, that's I suppose is true. But as we saw in the changes, and so I've been in policing a really long time. So as I saw that the dialogue change around children and abuse and neglect, we saw an increase in reporting. When laws changed and the dialogue around relationship violence, domestic violence changed, we saw the reporting go up. We knew that it was happening. I knew that it was happening when I was a young police officer in Burlington, because we saw what was happening out there. So when you change those mechanisms, those processes, when you break down some of the mythology around what is a very personal, very violent act, I think that you get better reporting. So I'm hoping that is what it is.
We're talking today about sexual assault on campus. College students or parents of college students, how present in your mind is the issue of sexual assault? And how big a problem is this in our state's schools? Are they doing enough to prevent sexual assault? We'd like to know what you think about. We're talking about this issue in light of new numbers on crime statistics that all schools around the country are required to release by October 1st. If you'd like to weigh in with your thoughts, your experiences, or your questions, you can post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that number is 1-800-639-2211. We got a note from Robin who says all instances need to be reported to police and not dealt with through the institutions. Amy Bremmel, how does that work at Castleton University when a student comes to the university with a charge of sexual assault?
It depends on what avenue they present. So if they report it to public safety, then they have options there of how they want to proceed. They can go through a campus resource option. They can go through an off-campus resource options. They're definitely reported for Cleary numbers. But what the student goes from through there, whether they access me through a victim's advocacy position or peer advocates for change or a counselor, even a faculty member, the student, it's up to them which process they want to choose on campus or off campus and how they want to proceed with a formal complaint or not filing for a formal complaint.
If a student files a formal complaint, does that go directly to the police?
Not necessarily. Again, it would depend upon the student themselves. And if they want to file with a criminal action, would be more with the police. The police definitely do still investigate our complaints that happen on campus and get involved. There is like a memorandum of understanding between our campus and our Castleton police for the whole investigation process.
Without getting too deep into the weeds, can you explain what that memorandum of understanding is?
I really can't. I can't speak to that. I'm not part of that investigative process. I'm more in the victim support angle. But I know there is a memorandum of understanding where they do work together and work together closely.
I know a lot of campuses around the state have that similar arrangement. Middlebury has an understanding with the police department in Middlebury. Chief Toomey, for UVM, the campus security presence is a deputized police force. So how does that work?
Well, it works the same. The university has an internal university system. The Title IX coordinator oversees that, and that's the part of the federal laws and regulations that actually brought women into, you know, policing, for one thing. So I'm a big fan of Title IX. Go. But in this particular case, they oversee the policies within the university. So the students have options of just using a university policy, and it's entirely up to the victim. The same as, and one of the other myths that I'd just like to speak to is that if a victim comes forward to report to the police a sexual assault, that doesn't mean that ultimately down the road they're going to end up testifying in court. Our first priority, my first priority, is the safety and well-being of the community and the public and of those victims. And that's exactly how the police departments are trained to deal with this. We're not thinking about, you know, prosecution, but it's a daunting task. So the students are advised of their options. They can proceed with a criminal investigation and a Title IX investigation, or one or the other or neither. And that's up to the victim. And how they move through this process and how they re-empower themselves to reassure their ground again.
And that's something that you deal with and the department deals with, even, you know, even as you are a police department, you'll have those conversations with a victim who comes forward to you first rather than to somebody else in the university?
Oh, absolutely. The university has a great deal of resources to support victims who come forward. And other people who are victimized by this. You know, there's a whole circle. It's a pebble in the pond kind of effect in these types of instances. So we're very quick to engage with our Women's Center, who isn't just for women, but that's where they're housed, where our victim advocate resides. We reach out immediately to the Title IX coordinator, to our counseling and psychiatry services, to our healthcare services. All of those provide wraparound immediate services and support to the victim to assure their well-being as best as possible. And it has nothing to do with whether they choose to report or not, whether they choose to go forward with continuing in a process that's either criminal or university sanctioned.
And for the department, are you required to proceed with a criminal investigation if an assault is brought to your attention, regardless of whether or not the victim wants to proceed with that?
No. And that's this is a, you know, all of my officers have advanced training in the state, but all police officers in the state of Vermont are trained as first responders to these types of instances. And they understand that supporting the victim is really important and is key. And this isn't about prosecution. This isn't about, you know, crime fighting or the arrest or anything else. It's really in intervening and creating a sense of safety.
Amy Bremmel, do you have a sense, when we talk about sexual assault on campus, of whether this problem, sort of in the very cozy atmosphere of a college campus, is how it relates to the atmosphere outside of a collegiate situation? Do you know if sexual assaults are perceived to be higher or lower than the general population?
I think they're definitely perceived to be higher. And part of that might be because of the hookup culture, and there's typically involved in college, not always, but drinking and parties and that atmosphere. I think statistics are up over 95% of hookups involve alcohol, and no surprise that about 95% of sexual assaults involve alcohol. And so just that environment, if you put a lot of students together, the similar age, similar atmosphere, and then add alcohol to the mix, it's definitely a recipe for bad things potentially to happen and consequences or risks involved.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that coming up after the break. We're talking about the issue of sexual assault on college campuses. The annual required reporting statistics have just been released by schools around the country, and we're talking with two women at our local schools about how they're addressing prevention efforts and advocating for more reporting when assaults do occur. Coming up, as I said, we're going to go deeper into this idea of alcohol. We have a listener question from Dave about drinking and enforcing underage drinking laws and if that would help in prevention efforts. We'd also like to hear from you about what you think would make campus a safer space and whether that means enlisting all students, not just potential perpetrators and potential victims, how all students need to be vigilant in addressing and preventing sexual assault. You can let us know your thoughts or your questions. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. UVM Police Chief Leanne Toomey and Castleton University Administrator Amy Bremmel are with us today talking about the problem of sexual assault on campus. Chief Toomey says college campuses should be on the leading edge of society when it comes to being a healthy, safe place for all people. But clearly, we are not there yet. So let us know what you think would help. What do you think would be the most effective way to prevent sexual assaults on campus? We're going to hear from Dave in a moment, who says, enforce underage drinking laws. We just heard from Amy Bremmel how often alcohol is involved in these instances. Do you think that would have an effect? What about education efforts? And what would make reporting easier for victims of sexual assault? We'd love to know your thoughts on this. I know many of you have had experiences, just statistically speaking, with sexual assault, maybe on a college campus. Maybe you want to talk about what your college campus did in terms of prevention efforts that you thought was particularly successful or ineffective. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can continue the conversation online on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. All right, let's get into Dave's thoughts here. He says, illegal underage drinking is a major factor in this. Isn't this one of the reasons the drinking age was raised to 21 all those years ago? Universities know illegal underage drinking is going on and do nothing to stop it. If they did, the sexual assault rate would probably decrease dramatically. Why doesn't some university try enforcing the drinking age law? Amy Bremmel, I'll go to you first at Castleton University.
I'm not sure if that would help or not. Like I said before, most sexual assaults do involve alcohol, but it's also part of the hookup culture. So people are connecting with individuals. Both have been drinking potentially, and the communication steps are not there. So the communication, whether it's to have sex at all, what does a hookup mean? What are we agreeing to do? Even to put on a condom, is that discussed? What are we both agreeing to do? The active consent piece might not be there if alcohol is part of the equation.
So why do you say you're not sure whether or not it would help? I mean, certainly what it sounds like you're saying is that taking alcohol out of the equation would affect the hookup culture and might affect many consensual sexual encounters. But why do you think it wouldn't affect the rate of non-consensual sexual encounters?
I'm sure it would have an impact. I'm just not sure to what degree.
But is that something that Castleton looks at in saying, here's one way that we can enhance our prevention efforts?
We definitely have. We have a wellness health educator on campus who is the public health approach, talking about harm reduction and risk reduction strategies with drinking and, you know, really talking about binge drinking, what that looks like, and where, you know, the different prevention efforts regarding alcohol and the intake levels and not having an open drink, not drinking from open containers. So that's definitely talked about on our campus.
But do you see it having any impact on sexual assault?
I would hope so.
When you say that, I can't tell whether you think it does or not.
Oh, no, I would hope that would definitely be the end result, is that, you know, harm reduction strategies, whether it's with sexual assault and alcohol and drug intervention and prevention, they go hand in hand.
And so the question would then be if people are just still not reporting when sexual assaults do occur, because it doesn't look like your numbers have changed over the last couple of years very significantly. I mean, they're very small numbers, so a little bit of a rise or a little bit of a decline is hard to Hard to decide if that's relevant or just a sort of a statistical blip, but it doesn't look like over the last couple of years the numbers are really changing much.
Well, I think a big piece of that, too, is that maybe why I shy away from saying, yes, that's definitely a definitive answer, is that it would have an impact, is because also the key piece is victim blaming. Mm-hmm. I think if a person has been drinking, then they'll be maybe less likely to come forward if we're saying, well, you shouldn't have been drinking, so therefore it's, you know, it kind of lends itself to that thought process. So I think that's where I kind of am a little bit hesitant to say that, yes, that would have a huge impact or not.
Mm. Chief Toomey, I see you nodding your head there. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking I completely agree with what Amy just said. You know, when you say thou shalt not, when you have this zero tolerance attitude around things, when people begin to believe that the answer to change what is a cultural and broad social issue that's occurring, such as crime in general, but in this particular case, what we're talking about is sexual violence, that enforcement isn't really the answer. We can't enforce our way out of this. University of Vermont, the residence halls went dry many years ago. And you can look at our numbers and you can see that even from the time before dry residence halls and that. So the idea that there being one fix to shift this cultural view is a little bit too simplistic for what's, you know, really big thing. You know, this is a big elephant and we're working at pieces of it. You know, the University of Vermont has a lot of the same programs going that Amy was talking about, as well as, you know, starting a men in, 1 in 4 chapter where men want to get involved in stopping sexual violence and continuing every year to engage with our Greek communities around risk reduction and those behaviors, which includes alcohol consumption, bystander intervention programs, orientation for the first year, because we find that our, you know, our first year students are, you know, are very vulnerable. So we have in a college community, we have a young, vulnerable population. We're bringing them in there. We're taking great strides in care to, you know, bring them up to that adult. You know, you're an adult now, behave like one, you know, really without the, you know, the front part of their brain being connected to the rest of it and not having that sense about, you know, cause and effect. So I don't think enforcement is going to make a change here. I think it really has got to be a mindset change. And what you had mentioned about me saying that, you know, colleges are this great opportunity to change the culture going forward. Well, we have this limited amount of time in this parade that we touch each time they come through every 4 years to change that group of people. And the university really is investing a great deal in that, in creating good citizens so they can bring about the broader cultural change. Because sexual assault's happening everywhere. I mean, I worked in it, you know, in Burlington and municipal policing, and it was happening there as well. And so I think colleges are positioned really well to impact our citizens going forward on how to, you know, make a difference in the future.
All right, listeners, your thoughts on prevention efforts, on the occurrence of sexual assault on campuses. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Liz calling in from Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Liz. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was in college about 10 years ago, and the atmosphere, I just want to talk, is completely different now. I was a victim, and I feel like the support system now is so much more than it was then. There was so much pressure and, like, what did I do wrong when it came to talking about my experience. But now I feel like college campuses really are trying. And it's not necessarily administrative. It's really students as well coming forward and creating their own groups and support systems and, like, speaking out against sexual violence. And it's kind of creating this overall sort of sense with people my age, even, of that it's our responsibility. It's people's responsibility of how they approach, like, sexual violence, and just sort of changing the dialogue on it. Of, like, it's not about who was drunk or what somebody was wearing or anything else. It's all about consent and the atmosphere that you create for each other.
Liz, thank you for calling and sharing your experiences. And it's interesting to hear you say what you observed in your own experience a decade ago versus what you're seeing now on college campuses. I really appreciate your perspective. Let's go to Devin in Middlebury. Hi, Devin. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey. I just wanted to say that in my experience, having gone to college less than 10 years ago, it may not be a simple, quick fix, but in my experience, one of the biggest contributors to creating situations where sexual assaults happen is the Greek system and fraternities in particular. And I just think it's probably time we take a look at the whole Greek system and see if it's really entirely relevant to a modern society.
Devin, thanks for your call. Appreciate that perspective. We actually did a show on the Greek system, I think almost a year ago now, and had a lot of perspectives on that idea of whether the Greek system is relevant in a number of different ways. I know UVM has a pretty strong Greek system, Dartmouth College in Hanover, very strong Greek system, lots of questions that these schools are grappling with, and that question of sexual assault as well. We'll double back on that while we're in this conversation, but let's in the meantime go to Dale and Shalott. Hi, Dale. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two comments that I'd like to make, that I'd like to hear more of in this this discussion.
Go right ahead.
Okay. One is I would love to have colleges and universities stop looking the other way when it comes to underage drinking. Yes, they're doing a lot, but they could do a lot more. And secondly, and more importantly, we have all these 18 to 21-year-old young men with hormones raging. I would love to see colleges and universities put more effort into giving these young men something other to do on Friday and Saturday nights than to party. I would love to see the gyms open up, have dodgeball and volleyball and lots of activities go on so they have something else to do.
Dale, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Amy Bremmel, how would you respond to Dale?
That's exactly what our college has done, or our university has done a lot of. Our campus activity board has really looked at doing a lot more late night programming, which has been extremely successful, hosting dances and what I would say like more like rave parties that are substance free, and they don't even start until like 11 o'clock at night. So much, they've been so successful so that even our Castleton police one time was like, nobody's downtown. Nobody's around and questioning what's going on campus tonight. So that has been a huge success. And having like more late night programming, including movies, magicians, comedians, things like that happen, kind of to offset the party atmosphere, especially on weekends where we know or suspect things could be that atmosphere could be a little bit more, such as like Halloween night or particular weekends where we know it's notorious for activities or parties going on. So we'll try to really load heavy on those events, those alternative activities.
So what else are you doing, Amy, in terms of strict prevention efforts? You know, that kind of activity talks a lot about the social life in general at Castleton University and what you're promoting and what the school thinks is sort of valuable to work on. So that's part of a prevention effort. What else are you doing?
Well, one other piece that I can speak to, the caller, Liz, who called in, that she had noticed some program changes between when she was on campus and now. And that's a huge piece, I think, of what we're all talking about today is a lot of the things we talked about that were prevention in the past are now what we're calling harm reduction and risk reduction strategies. Things like carrying pepper spray, taking self-defense classes, how you carry your keys. Do you talk to somebody, have a fake conversation while you're walking, parking under a light? All those things are still valid, and we talk about those things, but they're harm reduction and risk reduction strategies. So when we're talking about prevention, we really want to get at the root cause, which is the perpetrator. How do you get at their behavior? And the main focus or our main way at Castleton University is looking at bystander intervention and looking at when is a person either too intoxicated to give consent. So those two pieces are really important. Like bystander intervention, we all have a right and a voice to get involved. If we see something, say something, do something, stand up and speak out and get involved, something that might be a little off. One of the examples I give is if you see somebody right now at this time passed out, if you look out your window and you see them passed out in the grass, you're going to go and help them. So why doesn't that transfer or apply later on at night into a party atmosphere? Get involved and get them out of a harmful situation or a high-risk situation. Then we also do things not just a one-shot deal, but if you look at it from a public health perspective, long-term, not necessarily fear-based tactics. So we have Got Consent Days around campus where we have Got Consent shirts, which are the most sought-after thing on campus, is our Got Consent shirts. And we have certain days of the year where we wear those in solidarity. But we also have tabling events, which are educational awareness around campus. We do a lot of programming during the red zone, which is the greater higher risk period, the first 6 weeks of students on campus. And we're in the classrooms a lot with our orientation, our first year student seminars, and in the classrooms in general. And we meet those first year students in particular, we reach them at least three times within their first few weeks here on campus.
Interesting to hear about what you're doing on those sort of direct prevention and that idea of bystander intervention rather than harm reduction or harm risk control. We got a note from Elizabeth who says, why was a victim blaming email allowed to be sent out university-wide at UVM? And Chief Toomey, I want to address this to you because it came from your office. This was a CAT alert which goes out to the entire student body. And the CAT alert mentioned that on September 27th, police services received a report of a sexual assault that occurred at UVM Fall Fest. Deeper into that email was a note that started with, it is never a victim's total responsibility to prevent an assault, but the following tips can help you stay safe. And then not long after that, an email came directly from you apologizing for the language in that CAT alert. And I'll read a little bit from your message. You said, the wording in the CAT alert was significantly inappropriate as it served to insinuate that a victim may be partially to blame for not preventing a sexual assault or misconduct. This portion of the alert was taken from an outside resource was meant to be changed before publication due to its problematic nature. You also said that you take full responsibility for this error and feel deeply sorry for the mistake. So would you like to address Elizabeth?
Certainly. And I will say it publicly here on the radio. I am deeply sorry for that. It basically was a cut and paste error when we were trying to publish the details that we were trying to present. Some of the federal regulations that go with that require us, and rightfully so, and it's a good idea, to include tips for keeping yourself safe. We've received additional training and received those tips from a national trainer, and I didn't review them. We plugged them in to the end of that to meet the requirement, and quite frankly, I should have read the whole thing in its entirety. I would have picked up on the word totally the way everyone else did. Totally. Completely. And I just hope that my sincere apology is to the community that felt the harm by that. I completely recognize how powerful that is, and I completely recognized it afterwards. And again, really apologize to our community, the broader community that received those messages. That is not at all what we believe. The victim is never responsible. No victim is responsible for the violence that is perpetrated on them.
And just have a couple seconds left, but when Amy was talking about that idea of bystander intervention, is that something that you work on at UVM as well?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of other programs, but the bystander intervention program, I think, is that opportunity for all of us to kind of learn how to be better citizens, you know, how to, you know, if you see something, say something, how to overcome those types of things. And that is one of the programs amongst the myriad of other ones that you can find actually on the university website for the education resources available for everyone.
That's Chief Leanne Toomey. She's Chief of the University of Vermont Police Services. Thank you for being with us today. And Amy Bremmel, who coordinates Castleton University's CHANGE program, and CHANGE stands for Creating, Honoring, Advocating, Nurturing Gender Equity. Amy, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Dorothy's List, our monthly book club for kids. This month, we go into the psyche of Theodora Tenpenny, the heroine of Laura Marks Fitzgerald's novel Under the Egg. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's time now for Dorothy's List, our series about the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Each month during the school year, we visit with a group of middle grade readers to discuss one of the books nominated for the Vermont-based award. Today, VPR's Amy Noyes takes us to New Haven, where students at Beeman Elementary School have been reading the novel Under the Egg by Laura Marks Fitzgerald.
The fifth and sixth graders file down the stairs and into the school library like they've done hundreds of times before. They're the big kids at Beeman Elementary, and library time isn't just about read-alouds and checking out books anymore. Librarian Nancy Custer Carroll has a lesson for them on characters in Under the Egg. She reads the author's introduction to a new character.
Who's this? But Jack said she was different than all that. She used to go out, help with chores, go to school. Her teachers and professors used words like genius and extraordinarily gifted. But as the years went by, she withdrew deeper and deeper within herself. And now here she was, at her childhood desk, in her childhood room, working on a dissertation that NYU stopped expecting over 15 years ago. Tara, who's that?
That is Theo's mom.
Theo is the girl at the center of the story, and her mom isn't much help to her. Theo's grandfather has died, and now it's up to her to feed the chickens, tend the garden, make her own clothes, and make sure they can survive on the dwindling jar of money hidden in her grandfather Jack's studio. Theo also has a mystery on her hands. With his dying words, Jack told her to look under the egg. That instruction could be key to her survival, or it could mean something else entirely. And she's not even sure what egg he means. Is it the picture of an egg that hangs over the mantle in his painting studio? Or is it the bowl her grandmother made where they always placed the most perfect egg laid by their backyard chickens? Neither seems to make much sense. Fifth grader Trent Paquette wanted to ask this question of the book's author.
How did you get the story idea of Under the Egg?
We put Trent's question and others to Laura Marks Fitzgerald.
One of the central parts of the story came from when I was rereading the Little House on the Prairie series. It was in 2009, and it was right after the markets had crashed, and I was thinking a lot about the way that people in America were kind of living in a mini depression, a Great Depression, and the way that a lot of people, where I was living in Brooklyn, were going back to these sort of pioneer methods, and they were pickling things and canning things and raising chickens in their backyard. And I started thinking, what would it look like if Laura Ingalls Wilder lived in the center of New York City in the village? And that's how the character of Theo came about.
Theo soon finds out there is something hidden under Jack's painting of an egg, and it's another, much older painting. Here's author Laura Marks Fitzgerald reading that part of the story.
Within minutes, I'd come to a few conclusions. It looked old, probably Renaissance, maybe Italian. It looked real, like something I'd see in a big museum. It looked like it was worth something, maybe a lot. Which was strange because any painting of value from the original Tenpenny collection had been sold a long time ago. Jack had been a painter, not a collector. If there was some image he had admired, a sketch, a study, a scrap torn from a book or a magazine, he would have pinned it to the wall for reference, not hidden it from view for the last 13 years. Maybe, probably, longer. And this is where I got nervous. Because Jack wasn't just a painter. Not many painters are able to support their families with their art alone, no matter how frugal they are. No, Jack had worked a day job. As a security guard. At the Metropolitan Museum of Art. In the European Paintings Wing. Which brought me to another conclusion. The painting looked stolen.
Beeman School sixth grader Matthew Demers wants to know about the paintings in this art mystery.
Are all the paintings that are in the book, are they all real?
So, Matthew, every painting in the book is real except one. And the one that is entirely fictional is the one that she discovers, that Theo discovers under the egg.
Theo begins to suspect that the painting is a work by Italian Renaissance artist Raphael. Fitzgerald says she had to invent this particular painting.
The reason for it was this. I wanted this painting to tell a story about the life of Raphael, but I wanted it to tell a story that is still a little bit of a secret.
Art historians are still discovering small codes, riddles, and symbols that Renaissance artists hid in their paintings. In Raphael's case, they think he may have had a close relationship with one of his models, and he hid clues about her in some of his famous works.
And we don't have a whole lot of hints out there. So part of this idea for the story came to me when I thought, what if there was one painting out there that just told you everything? But it doesn't exist. So I had to make it up.
Fifth grader Cami Claudio said learning about the art was one of her favorite parts of the book.
About all the Raphaels and Leonardo da Vinci, because I really like art.
I was wondering how long it took to research and get all the information about all of the art.
Cami, let me tell you that I spent a lot of time on the research, and this is why. It's because the more I research, the more I can procrastinate doing the writing. I love doing research because you just get to read and discover and uncover, and one search leads you to another search and one story leads you to another story.
Fitzgerald says she spent 3 years researching and writing Under the Egg.
Along the way, I checked out hundreds of books from my library. I spent way too much time wearing pajamas and doing Google searches. I went to the Met. I went to the Center for Jewish History in New York. I went to Ellis Island. I went to all kinds of places that would lead me to sometimes to the answer to a question in the book, and sometimes just to the feel of a place that I wanted to capture.
There are two tricky things about writing an art mystery. One is all of the art history research. The other is plotting a surprise ending. That was on the mind of Beeman School fifth grader Sion Pegues.
I've tried writing things and then I thought, what will it turn out to be? And be like, no, that won't work. And then changed it.
Sion wondered if that happened to Laura Marks Fitzgerald when she was writing Under the Egg.
Was this the original plan, like Jack dying and Theo finding the painting and the mystery happening was this the original plan for your book?
I feel very strongly that if you're going to write a mystery, you have to know what the end is before you start writing.
Fitzgerald says the ending of a well-written mystery sneaks up on you, but the surprise seems so obvious when you're through.
And I love the experience where you think, oh my gosh, it all fits together. And now I want to go back to the beginning and read it again to see how all the pieces were adding up, and I didn't even notice it. That's the kind of book I wanted to write. So before I started writing, I plotted out every single page, chapter. I knew exactly going in from the very beginning, exactly what was going to happen.
The Beeman School students continue discussing how the characters help weave that mystery with librarian Nancy Custer Carroll.
Vying for valedictorian, you've got Leonardo da Vinci, the quirky super nerd, and Michelangelo, the angry but brilliant loner. Then you have the guy everyone wants to be seen with, the star quarterback who's been elected both class president and most popular. That's Raphael.
And sixth grader Logan Piero approves.
Yeah, it was really fun to meet all these characters.
And, realize it or not, the fun also came with some important lessons in art, literature, and history. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is Under the Egg by Laura Marks Fitzgerald. Thanks to teacher Arnell Paquette at the Beeman School in New Haven. Next month on Dorothy's List, The Port Chicago 50, a nonfiction book by Steve Scheinkin about a disaster in 1944 that led to a fight for civil rights. Here's an excerpt.
It was not until sunrise that the men of Port Chicago got a clear look at the scene of devastation. The huge open space leading down to the water was dotted with piles of rubble, burned grass, splintered wood. One 200-pound chunk of gray steel, part of one of the ships, clearly lay more than 200 miles from the pier. The men walked along the railroad tracks leading down to the bay. At the waterfront, where the pier used to be, two twisted rails stuck out a few feet from the shore and ended in the air above the water. The 1,200-foot pier was simply gone.
That's an excerpt from the Port Chicago 50, read by Beeman School fifth grader Sion Pegues. The Port Chicago 50 is nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award, and it's next month's selection in our series Dorothy's List, which is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. Join us tomorrow at this hour for a special program about the political career of Bernie Sanders, from his surprise victory as mayor of Burlington to a seat in Congress to his candidacy for president. We'll look at the rise and the record of Vermont presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. VPR presents Becoming Bernie tomorrow at noon and 7. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.